Paul Harris. Rolling through this, my final Friday show on the Big 550 KTRS. In the last segment, I was talking about things I've done and highlights from my career. Twice in my life, I had the weird moment of talking to my mom and my dad on the radio. My dad was first because he came out with a book for the centennial of the Statue of Liberty. He was a high school history teacher and historian who wrote several books, and one of them was about the Statue of Liberty as it was approaching its 100th anniversary. And at the time, I was doing the morning show on WYNY in New York when NBC used to actually be in the radio business. And so we were broadcasting from Rockefeller Center. It was me and another guy named Harris, a guy named Rick Harris. We were Harris and Harris in the morning. We even had a jingle to that effect, which I will not duplicate for you now. But I said to him, how about if we have my dad on the show? And he loved the idea. And we actually edited the jingle so it was Harris and Harris and Harris in the morning that day. And I had my dad on. And it was the first time my dad had ever been in the radio studio while I was doing my show. And he was thrilled to be there. And we had a great time. And he hung out with me all morning long. So that was one wonderful day. Another one was on the day I surprised my mother at work. She was a high school librarian and teacher. And it was the last day before she was retiring from that business after doing it for many, 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 many years. And I called the switchboard at the school live on the air from the station I was working at in Washington, D.C. at the time, and made them get her for me and put her on the phone and surprised her and talked to her for a few minutes. She was freaked out by it. I was actually more nervous that morning than any other time I've ever been in radio. I'm calling my mom live on the air and she doesn't know I'm calling. It was very, very strange. But those are not the only family members who have been on the radio with me. This next gentleman has been on with me several times. He's the one we refer to as the smart Harris brother. It's my brother Seth, who has had a remarkable career working in two presidential administrations. First as a senior advisor to the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, and then Alexis Herman in the Clinton administration, and then moving on to become Deputy Secretary of Labor under Hilda Solis in the Obama administration. He retired from government a few years ago and has hung out his shingle and is an attorney now. But I've asked him to join us here today and talk a little bit about all sorts of things. Hi, Seth. How are you?
I'm doing well, and congratulations on your last show and 40 remarkable years in radio. It's really been an amazing ride, and let me just say, I think I may be the only person, apart from Mom and Dad, who've seen the whole thing, from your days in high school radio, college radio, that tiny little bunker in a blown-down drive-in movie lot in Riverhead, Long Island, to the high of radio in New York and Philly and Washington and now in St. Louis. So what a privilege it is to be on this last show with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now let's talk about you. You, as the Deputy Secretary of Labor, that makes you effectively the COO, the Chief Operating Officer of the Labor Department, as it does the Deputy Secretary in any of the cabinet departments. We have just gone through our second government shutdown in the last month, even though it only lasted 5 hours in the middle of the night. You had to have gone through some of those while you were in each of those administrations, am I right?
I did. I went through two during the Clinton administration in 1995 and 1996, and then one in the Obama administration when I was the deputy secretary. And then there were a number of times during the Obama administration when we prepared for government shutdowns. Let me just say, the best kind of government shutdown is the one that we saw last night. It happens overnight. It's like a tree falling in the forest. Nobody hears it. Nobody experiences it. And everybody just shows up to work the next morning.
Yeah. But when it doesn't happen that way and the government actually is going to shut down, or when you're preparing for it ahead of time, I joked that I was going to ask you about this today, and they said, well, the answer is just don't come to work. But you can't do that with how many people are there in the Labor Department?
There are 17,000 employees and 4,000 contractors in 23 different organizations spread all across the United States, some in different parts of the world. This is shutting down an organization of that size under the rules that govern people in government, which are very, very detailed and complicated, is extraordinarily complicated and costly. It took us weeks and weeks to prepare for shutting down the Labor Department. And then, of course, you lose all the time and effort during the shutdown when people could be out, you know, saving lives, getting people their paychecks, protecting their pensions and health care, and instead they're sitting at home unsure if they're going to get paid. So it's incredibly disruptive. Just preparing for it is disruptive, but when they really shut it down, then, man, it does a lot of damage.
Aside from the disruption, the thing that got me is that you said it's costly, because people would think, okay, you shut down the government, we're saving tax dollars. Is that not the case?
No, it's not the case. So there's a number of ways in which it costs money. First of all, even though the law doesn't require that federal employees who are sent home or furloughed during a government shutdown get paid, every single time there's a government shutdown, Congress passes a law and ends up paying federal employees for time they did not work. So that's wasted money. You're basically giving people a paid vacation, involuntary paid vacation. But in addition to that, you know, government is run also by a lot of contracts with a lot of different enterprises. And so often you have to reorganize those contracts and add money to the contracts and change schedules. And I mean, it's just a very involved process, which ends up costing the government and the taxpayers money. It's a huge waste. It's a couple of billion dollars a day that get wasted in doing this. So Wow. It's really a disaster.
Yeah. Wow. Now let's talk about some labor-related issues, because every month when the job numbers come out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I know you get called upon by CNBC or MSNBC or CBS or one of the other news outlets and print and online outlets as well. They want your thoughts on what happened when the unemployment numbers come in. And I know the most recent report had what they call the jobless claims, which is not the same as unemployment, is it?
No, right. That's what people call the jobless claims report. It goes out on Thursday every week, and it tells us how many people have newly filed for unemployment benefits during the preceding week.
Well, when that comes out, and then when the unemployment numbers themselves come out, there's always question about what does it mean. So what do the recent numbers that we've seen mean for our economy and for American people?
You know, and this is one of the big jokes among those of us who every first Friday of the month get on Twitter, get on television, get on radio, and talk about these jobs numbers. Any one-month report really doesn't tell you very much. You've got to look at longer-lasting trends. And the truth of the matter is we have had job growth in the United States for 88 consecutive months, right, dating back to the middle of President Obama's first term. Wages have been growing fairly slowly, fairly steadily for several years now. So what you're looking for is specific measurements of particular issues below those headlines, right? Below the headline of we're creating jobs, the economy is doing just fine, workers are doing a little bit better, not as much better as they should be doing. So what are we worried about? You're worried about things like African-American unemployment or Latino unemployment, unemployment among young people. We're looking for how many people are involuntarily working part-time, people who'd like to work full-time but are working part-time. I'm very focused on the wages number. I think a lot of Americans are very upset that for several decades now, there haven't been real raises going to most Americans. Their pay has not been going up. So that's what I'm focusing on when we talk about these reports. And it does give you a picture of how the economy is going overall. And the answer right now is it's going just fine.
It's going just fine. And yet there are some people who are still going to suffer. You always have that end of the economy. And the other people who are going to thrive. What has happened recently that makes that inequality between those two ends of the spectrum even greater?
In a word or in a phrase, it's President Trump's tax cut bill is going to dramatically exacerbate the already very serious problem we have in our country of income inequality. Very simply, the rich are getting richer and have been getting richer than ever. And working class people, middle class people, certainly poor people, have seen their incomes either stagnate or go down. And wealth has done the same thing. So when you hear people talking about, for example, the stock market has been very volatile in the last few days. It went down several, more than 1,000 points yesterday. It's up pretty much today. But, you know, only 10% of Americans own more than 80% of stock value on Wall Street. So half of Americans own nothing on Wall Street. So those people are not affected when the stock market rises dramatically. So when you hear President Trump take credit for the stock market going up, that's a good thing for people like you and me who have some money in the market. But for a large percentage of Americans, it means absolutely nothing to their well-being, and they are being left behind when wealth is flowing to the wealthiest people in our country.
Okay, now I want to ask you more about tax cuts, because it seems to me that whenever we get fiscally conservative people, Republicans, in office, when they take office, or when they just get, you know, into a legislature, one of the first things they want to do is they want to cut taxes. They always want to cut taxes, but there has to be a certain point at which you have to stop cutting taxes because you're just not getting enough money into your state. I know, for instance, in Oklahoma, most of the schools there can't afford to be open 5 days a week. They're only open 4 days a week. Prosperity has been driven down because they've cut things to the bone there. Kansas was the bellwether for this. They were the first one to go out and do this, and that state is in terrible shape now. Does this all go back to the failures of trickle-down economics?
The way in which President Trump and the Republican Congress cut taxes, the answer to that is yes. There are ways to cut taxes that will significantly benefit the economy and will narrow that income and wage gap that we were talking about, address that inequality problem that we have. So, for example, cutting taxes for middle-class people, cutting taxes for low-wage workers, for example, by increasing the earned income tax credit, or by giving people a larger child care tax credit, which, by the way, was included in the Trump tax cut bill, those kinds of things that help middle-class people spurs the economy, because working-class and middle-class and poor people spend every dollar they get, right? If you give a dollar to an unemployed person or a middle-class working person, as soon as they get it, the odds are they're going to turn around and pay a bill, put a dollar of gas in their car. They're going to maybe do a little improvement to their house. They're going to maybe save it for retirement or put it in a kid's college fund. But more likely, they're going to save it. Well, that then helps the economy as a whole to grow. But if you give that same dollar to a billionaire or a millionaire, right, they're not going to spend it. How many Lamborghinis and pots of caviar can one person consume in a lifetime? They don't need it. They don't want it. So they're going to save it, or they're going to figure out a way to put it offshore in the Cayman Islands, and it's not going to stimulate growth in the economy. So the kind of tax cuts that we've seen in places like Kansas and Oklahoma, and also in at the federal level now with the Trump tax
cut. And let me add, by the way, the new governor of Missouri, Eric Greitens, wants to cut hundreds of thousands of dollars out of the budget here as well, following the lead of those other states.
Right, but it doesn't, I mean, there's a lesson here, and that is it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. And let me also say, I don't think it's really intended to work. You know, we have an economy right now that's growing at a fairly healthy rate, not as much as some people would like. It's growing well. Unemployment is very low. Tax cuts are intended to stimulate the economy, but the economy is already doing just fine. So stimulating it just as an economic matter doesn't make any sense. Instead, that money should be spent on targeted investments that are going to solve big problems in our economy, like education, like infrastructure. Infrastructure would make the economy run better, and it would put millions of middle-class, middle-wage, middle-skill Americans to work. You know, making sure that everybody has access in rural areas areas to broadband. That will make them more productive and also improve the quality of their lives. There are a lot of targeted investments that will make life better and make our economy better, but huge tax cuts for the rich don't produce good outcomes for the economy, certainly in circumstances like those that we're in right now.
You know what you sound like? It sounds like you're running for office.
I would never, ever, ever run for office. Never run for office. I've seen a lot of friends who do it, and I honestly don't know how they do it. I'm happy to be a former appointed official.
Yeah. And by the way, if he runs for office, they connect him to me, and that's it. He'll never get elected. Speaking of elections, you've been very good in prognosticating things. You and I have had many, many private discussions over the years for decades about elections, and you've always been able to spot what was going to happen. So the GOP has won the popular vote in the presidential election exactly once in the last 28 years. That was in 2004 when George W. Bush got more votes than his opponent. That's the only other time. The rest of the time, it has been the Democrats winning the popular, not the Electoral College vote. And yet, they continue to have this power, and certainly in state houses around the country, they have way, way, way more much power than the Democrats do. What can the Democrats do, not only in the 2018 elections, but also in the 2020 presidential elections, to tip the scales back to them?
Right. So I'm not a big proponent of this argument that the rules are skewed to benefit one party or another party. That's true in some cases. For example, districts in the U.S. House of Representatives are very heavily gerrymandered to benefit the Republicans. And, you know, President Trump would not have won if it hadn't been for the Electoral College. But the fact is, we know what the rules are. We know what the districts are. And we know how the district lines get drawn by state legislatures after every decennial census, right? There'll be a census in 2020, and legislatures around the country will redraw state legislative lines and congressional district lines anew right after the census is written. So we all know what the rules are. The job is to win no matter what the rules are. And Democrats, frankly, have not been good at doing that. Now, President Obama, who's really a once-in-a-generation quality politician, was able to do that. Bill Clinton was able to do that, also a once-in-a-generation quality politician with more flaws, of course. But Democrats under President Obama lost 1,000 state legislative seats, lost control of the House, lost control of the Senate. So he was not able to translate his personal political brilliance into party building and success under the rules as they existed. So it's, as I used to say, my son, as you know, your nephew, played high school basketball. And I used to say to him all the time, if you're yelling at the referee about the last play of the game, then you deserved to lose because you knew that there was going to be a last play of the game and you needed to be ahead by 3 or 4 or 5 baskets to make sure you were going to win. It's the same thing with the Democrats. We need to go out there and organize and persuade people and motivate our base constituency to get out and vote and then win these elections.
And who's going to do that? It's not going to be Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, is it?
No, it's going to be people on the ground in state legislative races and congressional races and gubernatorial and senatorial elections who are going to speak directly to their constituents and let them know how we would govern, how we Democrats would govern differently than Republicans. That happened in Virginia, where Ralph Northam ran for governor and won an election by a much wider margin than anybody expected. Democrats almost took back the lower house in Virginia, the House of Delegates. They missed by one seat. And even though those seats are very, very heavily gerrymandered in favor of the Republicans, and they did that by running a lot of women, people of color, working class men, people who really knew their communities and got out and talked to the voters. And I think that's what's going to make the upcoming races in Missouri very interesting, because Claire McCaskill understands that about politics. She needs to go out and really meet her constituents and persuade them and respond to their concerns. So I even though a lot of people are predicting that she's going to have a lot of trouble in this election, and I think it's going to be close, she's the kind of politician who understands that all politics is local, and she needs to go out and talk to the locals.
Well, we may be seeing something just in the special election in Missouri this week, where a district that went 28% positive for Trump elected a Democrat this week by about 106 votes, but still a Democrat won in a heavily red district. And we'll see if that trend is going to continue. I will continue to turn to you for insight in this. It just won't be on my radio show anymore. And I thank you so much for coming on here, and I look forward to seeing you.
Pleasure. Congratulations again.
Thanks. My brother Seth Harris here with Paul Harris, the Harris Brothers, 2 for 1 on the Big 550 KTRS.